This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Very briefly scan over the main points of the series of shiurim that I gave over Sukkos, and then focus on to the issue of this evening. So those of you who are at those shiurim, it will serve as a summary, and those who weren't will at least get an idea of the topics that were covered. The essential focus of those shiurim was to tie together five themes of Sukkos. The five themes of Sukkos are, number one, that there's a global element to Sukkos. It's the only Yom Tov on which there's an emphasis of our relationship with the nations of the world, with the non-Jewish world. It doesn't seem to be a Yom Tov that is one in which we're totally preoccupied with our own well-being. The second theme is, of course, the Darad Minim, the Lulav and Esrog. The third theme is the Sukkah itself. The fourth theme is the Simcha, that as much as every Yom Tov is a time of Simcha, a time of joy, Sukkot is a time of extreme joy. And the fifth theme is the Re'iyah, which applies not only to Sukkot but to all the Yom Tovim, to all the Sholosh Regolim, the obligation to come to the Beis HaMikdosh and see and be seen, so to say, by the Ribbono Shel Olam. And very briefly, I'm only going to touch on the key topics of each of these to create the link between them all in order to understand the essence of it. Now, starting point was a very contradictory Rashi in Parshas Pinchas. The Rashi says that on the one hand, the bulls that were brought as a sacrifice on Sukkot, there are 70 altogether, 13 on the first day, 12 on the second day, 11 on the third day, down to 7 on the seventh day, and the total of the number of bulls is 70, represents the 70 nations of the world, and that the Gemara says, which is our first inkling to the concept of the globalism of Sukkos, that the korbanos have an element of occupation with the nations of the world. And then Rashi adds Simon, and that Simon kaloy Elohim, that the fact that the numbers of bulls decrease, that we start off with 13 on the first day and 12 on the second day and 11 on the third day, is a sign that the non-Jewish nations will ultimately be wiped out. And then he says, and in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, it used to save them from suffering. It used to save the goyim from suffering. And we said this was very contradictory, because to say that the 70 bulls refer to the 70 nations, that's clear, that the Gemara says. Furthermore, the Gemara says that when they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, when the goyim destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, they didn't realize that they were destroying the source of their own blessing. They used to benefit, particularly on Sukkot, they used to benefit from the korbanos, from the sacrifices that we brought on Sukkot, more than anything else. And they destroyed the source of that very blessing that we used to bring to them. So the idea of bringing those 70 bulls is an occupation with the well-being of the nations of the world. And as Rashi himself says, we were matzilo miyisurim, we used to save them from suffering that way, by davening for them and by bringing brocha and so on. We used to avoid any kind of suffering. So why does Rashi say, and the simon chaloy Elohim? At the same time, he says that the fact that the numbers decrease is a sign that they're going to be wiped out. And we pointed out, in fact, two views in the Mishnah in Sukkot Daf Mem Zayin as to whether it was very important to bring the right number of bulls every day. Whether you had to bring the 13, if you didn't have 13, what would you do if you didn't have 12 on the second day or 11 on the third day? And there was one view was that it didn't really matter. Although the number 70 seemed to be important, it wasn't that important how many you brought on each day. And the other view was, no, absolutely not. It had to be that order, and it had to be that number. You couldn't deviate from that at all, even if you didn't have the right numbers. That blew the whole system. That blew the whole korban. You couldn't bring the korban at all. That was the view of the Rabbonin in the Mishnah. And we suggested that according to the view that the number of each day is very important, that's really where Rashi gets it from, that the decreasing number is very important to the whole image created by the 70 bulls that are brought. But we asked in that case, why does it start with 13 and go down to 7? It should rather start with, if it's going to start with 13, it can start with any number, 13, 15, 20, start with whatever you want and go down to 0. if you want, if you're talking, if the image is a simon kaloyo lagoyim, if it's a sign that the non-Jewish world will ultimately be eradicated, surely you should stop at zero, not at seven. Why does it start at 13 and why does it end at seven if the image is one of total destruction, of total annihilation? And to answer that, we use the whole theory that Hirsch uses with korbanos. And we show that there really are three different types of animals that are brought on Sukkot, and they represent three different things. Sheep are brought, rams are brought, and bulls are brought. Sheep are brought, Hirsch's whole image with sheep is that's our passive religious side, where we follow the Ribbono Shel Olam unquestioningly. Ribbono Shel Olam gives us mitzvahs, we do the mitzvahs, we listen to the leaders, we're submissive, we're obedient. That's the image of the sheep. The isle, the ram, the image of the ram is leadership. And usually it's one ram that is brought, there's one leader that leads the sheep. So we've got with the ram, we've got the concept of leadership, and with the sheep we've got the concept of following. Both important elements in the nation of Klal Yisrael. The bulls, he says, are the concept of work, of toil, of the involvement in the world, engagement in the world, the normal activity of commerce and industry. That's what the bulls represent. Now, taking that into account, it then emerges that we have on Sukkot not just representatives of each of those lots, sheep, rams and bulls, but we have two teams of each. Because Hirsch points out, on every Yom Tov you've only got seven sheep. This Yom Tov we've got 14. That means we've got two teams of seven. Every Yom Tov you've got one aisle. This Yom Tov you've got two alien, two rams instead of one. So that means two teams of one each. So we've got two teams of seven sheep each, two teams of one ram each. Now the problem is when we get to the bulls, because we've got 13 bulls, and we can't say we've got two teams of 6.5 bulls each. So what do we say over there? It says, Hirsch, one team of seven, one team of six. That's what happens on the first day Sukkot. What does that mean? Explains Hirsch, in the area of the sheep, when it comes to the obedient following of religious dictates, the goyim have their way. The one team represents the nations of the world and the other team represents us. They've got theirs and there's seven. Seven, the number seven represents sanctity. So the goyim have their sanctity. They believe in God and they serve God in their way and they have their religious worship and that's okay and that will always continue. And we have our seven. The two teams function on their own. One team of seven, another team of seven. When it comes to the rams, that's leadership. They have their leaders, we have our leaders. We don't want to lead the Catholic Church, and we don't want to lead any other denominations or religions. We only want to lead the Jewish world, and they must lead theirs, and the leadership, you've got one ram for us, one ram for them. Separate leadership. There is no engagement in our religious activity. We cannot share religious activity, and we cannot engage with them in religious activity. They must serve God their way, and we must serve God our way. In leadership, we cannot engage. They must lead their way, and we must lead our way. We have different philosophies of leadership. And we must lead our way and they must lead their way. But when it comes to the bulls, to the secular world, to the world of work, there's a major difference. We have seven and they have six. Seven represents sanctity because we believe the same sanctity that we have in the sheep side of us, in the shul, in the obedience, in the following of the mitzvahs, it's exactly the same when we're working. We're serving Hashem and we're working as well. So the number seven reappears when it comes to the bulls. In our working life, we're also bound by the number seven rather than the number six. Not so the non-Jewish world. The non-Jewish world works around the number six. Seventh day of Shabbat, 6 days are the days of work. They separate work from religion. They separate work from sanctity. They separate their professional life from their religious life. And that's why they do have seven sheep. Their religious life is religious. But their business life is secular. With us, our religious life is religious and our business life is religious. And then what begins to happen? Our stays at number 7, so the second day, they're 12 altogether. That's 7 plus 5. And the third day, it's 7 plus 4. 7 plus 3, 7 plus 2, 7 plus 1, 7 plus 0. So the non-Jewish team of bulls gets wiped out. It does get to 0. All that remains is the Jewish team of bulls. Now what does that mean? That doesn't mean that the non-Jewish world gets wiped out. There's no nevuah that suggests that when Mashiach comes, there won't be non-Jews around. That's not the intention of the Bria at all. That's not the intention of the Ribbono Shel Olam at all. In fact, in the Haftarah of the first day of Sukkot, we learned that the non-Jews will come to Yerushalayim on Sukkot, and they will bring sacrifices to Hashem. And those that don't come and bring sacrifices won't get rain, the Navi says in Zechariah. If they don't come, they're not going to get rain. They're not going to get material blessing. Their material blessing will depend on them coming to Yerushalayim and recognizing that in the area of work as well, God is boss. That in the area of their secular activities, of their professions and their industry, they have to come to Yerushalayim, they have to daven to Hashem. That all works through the Beis Hamikdash. And so what is destroyed is the concept of six in the non-Jewish working world. There will only be a concept of seven. They will understand that even in the non-Jew, even in the area of work, even in the area of toil, it's necessary to be guided and governed by the will of Hashem and by the Torah. So what gets wiped out is secularity. What gets wiped out is the separateness of secular from religion. What gets wiped out is a perception that the 6 days of the week are disconnected from Shabbos. That's what gets wiped out. What they learn, what the goyim will learn, is that the concept of six doesn't apply anywhere. Seven sheep, separate. You have your religion, we have our religion. Two rams, separate. You have your worship, you have your leadership, we have our leadership. When it comes to the bulls, at the end of Sukkot, when Sukkot has worked, when the message of Sukkot has been carried through, only one team. And what does that teach us? That teaches us that there's only one area in which we can engage with the world, and that's in the area of commerce and industry. That's the only area we can engage. We can't share in any other area. They have their philosophies, we have ours. They have their religions, we have ours. They have their literature, we have ours. The one area that we can engage in, that we can impact in the world, and that we're meant to impact in the world, is our involvement in commerce and industry. That's where we interface, that's where we interact, and that's where we need to be. And through that we bring them, as the Haftarah says on the first day of Sukkot, to the point where we say, "Bayomahu yiyeh Hashem echod ushmo echod." Then there will be real monotheism, there will be real belief in one God, when the nations of the world also recognize that their material blessing depends on the Ribbono Shel, that their material well-being depends on the Ribbono Shel. And how will that be achieved? Through the way we set the example, through the way we interact and interface with them, at the one point where legitimate interface is permitted, and that's in the area of work, that's in the area of our industrial activity. We then went on to say that this bracha, this blessing that we bring to the world, has two parts to it. It has rain is a result, is a very important theme of Sukkot, is rain, whatever we do, the korbanos, as well as the arba minim, the four species. Why is it so agricultural? Why do we walk around with this little mini tree in our hands all the time? Because we're talking about agricultural growth. That's a very important part of the Sukkot theme. And the two parts that are important to growth are water and light. And I brought you a medrash in Tehillim that says those are the two things we bring on Sukkot. That's what the goyim need to appreciate, that on Sukkot, when we used to bring these sacrifices, we used to bring blessing to the world in the form of water and light, both of them being the sources of growth. And I discussed also that growth is something that is global. This ties into the global concept, because you can't have growth in isolation. The more you insulate a section of your population, and the smaller that section is, the more difficult it is to achieve economic growth. The smaller the unit of economy is, the more difficult it is to have economic growth. So if you open a little shop, and you've got a lot of money, but nobody else in your environment has got a lot of money, your shop is going to go out of business. No matter how much you've got, and no matter how good your shop is going to go out of business because the environment can't support it. There aren't people there who've got as well. So in order for you to be able to do well, you need other people who are doing well too. It's one of the very important things of business, and that's why we've often said that there are a lot of things. It's not just that a business activity, one can introduce a sanctity to it. Not only that, a business activity can teach a sanctity. There's an aspect of it that one can learn from it, and that is the understanding. And a lot of people find it very difficult to understand in business, that in business the best thing for your business is that everybody else is well off too. The worst thing for your business is to do everybody in, so that you're the only one who's well off. You'll strangle yourself. You can't operate like that. The more your clientele, the more your customer base is affluent and well off, the better your business will do. The better off your suppliers are, the better your business will do, the more they can do for you. So part of business is investing in the well-being of the very people that you're living on. So business is not taking from people. Business is giving to people, because the more you give to people, the more you've got. And those businesses that are beginning to understand that are beginning to grow at phenomenal rates. Businesses think you're taking from your employees, and the harder you work them, the more you'll get. It doesn't work that way. The more you take from your customer, the more you'll get. It doesn't work that way. The more you give to your customer, the more you'll get. The more you take from your supplier, the more you'll get. Take the longest credit terms you can. Squeeze him at every place that you... It doesn't work like that. You put him out of business and then you've got no supplier. The better off, the more comfortable your supplier is in dealing with you, the better off you are. And research has been undertaken already showing that the companies that are growing the fastest are the companies that understand this. That growth comes from investing. Growth comes from building the people around you, building your stakeholders, not squeezing your stakeholders. That should be the concept that business teaches. You can't have brocha in isolation. Brocha, if you want blessing, it's got to be b'harvocha. Everybody gets the benefit of it. There's nothing you can do about that. That's just how it is. You can't have thriving business for the Jews. Thriving business, you have a thriving business for everybody. The Jews benefit. But you can't, as I said on Sukkot, you can't ask for rain in Sydenham and Yeovil and Glenhazel. If it's going to be rain, it's going to be everywhere. If there's going to be sunshine, it's going to be everywhere. If you don't like that, so sit in the dark without rain. If you want to be mean and you want it only for the Jews, you're not going to get it at all. It doesn't work that way. It only worked that way in Mitzrayim, where the Jews had light and the Goyim didn't. But that wasn't because the light was restricted to Goshen. That was, the light was everywhere. Darkness was introduced to block out the light. And there wasn't blockage in Goshen. It's interesting. Hashem didn't bring the plague of darkness by simply turning off the lights in the rest of Egypt and leaving them on in Goshen. You can't do that. Well, Hashem won't do that. Can't turn off the light somewhere. He created a darkness which overwhelmed the light. And he didn't create that in Goshen. But if there's light everywhere. If there's rain everywhere. If there's plenty everywhere. That's the nature of brocha. That's what's special about brocha. That's what is abundant. Brocha in itself means abundance. And abundance means non-selective. Abundance means everybody benefits from it. When one begins to understand that in reality and begins to live that way, does one's life begin to change. One's business life changes, one's health changes, one's enjoyment of life changes, when you begin to realize that your well-being depends on other people being well-off more than it depends on you being well-off. That the more well-off the people around you are, the better off, the easier life is for you, not the worse life is for you. It's a hard thing to understand in reality, but an important one. And then he said, that's really interesting. If Sukkot is a time for sunshine and for rain, and for growth, then the sukkah is a very interesting structure for such a time. So we go into our sukkahs and we ask for rain. What is a sukkah? A sukkah is a structure capable of defending you from all the elements except rain. That's what a sukkah is by definition. If rain can't get in, it's a possible sukkah. If there's too much sunlight, it's also a possible sukkah. So you need to be protected from the sun and from all the other elements. From wind you need to be protected, otherwise the sukkah is possible. The only thing you're not protected from is rain. And where do you go out there into your sukkah and ask for? You go out and ask for rain. It's a very peculiar thing. Surely it should be the other way around. If you're going to go out and ask for rain, Hashem should tell you to sit in a structure which will protect you from the very rain that's going to come. And we discussed that and said this world is an interesting place. Because rain, geshem, is loshen gashmius. Geshem is the material motivator of growth. Sunlight is the spiritual motivator of growth. Light is energy, and energy has a spiritual aspect to it. Water is much more material. Water is much more gashmi. It's the same word. The word for material in Hebrew is gashmi. That comes from geshem, from rain. Rain is the earthy substance that creates growth, and sunlight is the spiritual force that encourages growth. The two together give bracha. If you've got no sun, you've got no growth. If you've got no water, you've got no growth. So the two together is what we bring on Sukkot, and that creates growth. The Sukkot protects us from sun, but not from rain. What does that mean? It's interesting that the earth is the same. There's no protection from rain, no natural protection from rain. If you're out in the bundu and there's a thunderstorm, you get wet. There's nothing you can do about it. You get wet. Every drop of water that comes down on the area that you're standing lands on you. There's no filtering, there's no protection, that's it. Sunshine is not the same. Sunshine, they told me now that you've got to be careful in South Africa for the next few weeks because the hole in the ozone layer is right overhead, and that can cause a lot of damage and death from the sun, and one has to be very careful in South Africa over the next 6 weeks. What does that mean? So the earth was given an ozone layer to protect us from the sun rather than from the water. Let's take that into a more Kabbalistic frame of mind and say that what that would mean then is that this world protects us from spirituality, not from the material. We get exposed to matter in this world and protected from spiritual. Very interesting, but it's quite true. Because if we were to be faced with the full force of Hashem's spiritual presence, we would have no free choice. It would be so overwhelming that we would not be able to grow. Part of growth is development, and that's free choice. And that's making mistakes, as we'll discuss later on, is part of that growth. That's the only way one can grow. There's no way we would risk ever making a mistake if we were exposed to the absolute force of Hashem's presence. So what is this world? Hashem withdraws himself, the Tzimtzum. Hashem takes himself out of the world, he hides away, he hides in the background. We're protected from the overwhelming presence of Hashem's absoluteness, from Hashem's infiniteness. Up in the world to come, up in the Olam HaEmes, there we've got it, we don't need that exposure. So just as the world is coated with a protected environment, with a protective layer, to protect us from the sun, the spiritual source of growth, so the world in a Kabbalistic sense is designed to protect us from the spiritual force of God, which can be too much for us. We need the force of energy for growth, but not too much, it can destroy us. But from material things, we're not protected at all. Material things, this world is material, and it's all open here. We can sink ourselves in it, we can drown ourselves in it, we can engage in it, we can run away from it, we can do what we want. There's no barrier between ourselves and the material world. It's at our fingertips, we can do what we want, we can make it, we can destroy it, we can ruin it, we can, whatever we want. We have complete open access to the physical world and very restricted aspect to the spiritual world. And that's the sukkah. Open access to rain, very restricted access to sunshine. That's the sukkah. And what's the message? The message is, what are we trying to bring to the world on sukkahs? We're trying to bring material growth. That's what sukkahs is about. It's not the spiritual growth. Of course, in all growth there is spirituality. Growth is spiritual. But we're trying to bring the essential nature of the growth that we're bringing on sukkahs is material growth. If you want material growth, the message of sukkahs is go out there and live out there with it. You can't sit in the protection of your home and ask for rain. When you're isolated from it, when you don't understand rain, when you're not tuned into it. Those of you who were sitting in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres this night, do you remember how tuned in you were to thunder, to lightning, to the sound of wind, to how cloudy it was? Tuned in, all of a sudden you're aware of it. If you were having supper inside, you wouldn't have even noticed that a storm was brewing outside. The storm never materialized, but we were tuned into it. Is it going to rain? Isn't it going to rain? You smell the rain, you're aware of the clouds. There's a relationship with nature, particularly with the rain aspect of nature, that you have when you're sitting out in the sukkah and you're exposed to rain, that you don't have when you're sitting inside and you're isolated from rain. The chiddush of sukkahs is that if you want to bring rain, you need to be tuned into rain. You can't sit in an isolated place and bring brocha somewhere distant where you have no relationship, where you have no kesher, where you have no contact, whatever, with the very thing you're trying to bring. And we said that the sukkah was a microcosm of the world, as we've just described. And that means that the message of sukkahs is, and as we discussed on Shmini Atzeres, it's the end of the season of engagement in the world. Because certainly in Israel there was a 6 month season. There was 6 months when the people were out there working in the field, developing, involved in commerce and industry, and 6 months when they were withdrawn and they sat at home and they learnt and they studied and they prepared themselves. That's how the year functioned. And Sukkot represents the end of that period, but its emphasis is the need to engage, the need to be involved, the need to be tuned in to what's happening out there in the world, not to be insulated from what's happening in the world. And so the global aspect, the agricultural aspect of the four minim, the growth aspect of the four minim, and the concept of sukkah now all begin to tie in together. The fourth element was that of simcha. Now simcha, we said, was a very important element in sukkahs, an important element altogether, because simcha has a lot to do with our whole relationship with the world outside. And what is simcha and how do we develop simcha? We discussed that at some length, and I'm just going to summarize it very briefly. And say that the essence of simcha is being able to enjoy what you're given. Being able to, we talked about the simcha of receiving a gift and what that really means, and how important and valuable that is to a person. And we said one of the gifts that one has to be able to enjoy on sukkahs is the sukkah itself. We based that on the Chazal that said in Gemara Sukkah that Tes Kashem Shechal Shem Shomayim Al HaChagigu Kein Chal Shem Shomayim Al HaSukkah. Just as God's name applies to the sacrifice of the Chagigo, so it applies to the Sukkah. And Rashi explains there that what does that mean? That the sacrifice of the Chagigo, you bring your sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash, it's yours. You hand it over to the Kohen. At that point, it ceases to be yours and you're not allowed to have any benefit from it at all. Until the insides of the animal are brought on the altar, and then you can have benefit from the korban. You can eat the korban, in fact, after that. So there's a time during which you're not allowed to have any access, any benefit from it at all. What's the meaning of that time? Explains Rashi, so that you should realize that mishulchon gavoya kozochi. When you eat your sacrifice, you should realize you're eating a gift of Hashem. It wasn't yours for a while. It started off being yours. You then gave it to Hashem, and Hashem has now invited you to partake of that meal. So it wasn't yours to start. You're not getting it from your own source of income. You're getting a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what it is there. In the same way, the sukkah itself, the body of the sukkah, is muktzah during sukkah. So you're not allowed to get benefit from the sukkah other than to sit in it. And why is that? So explain what that chazal means is the same concept, that you should realize the sukkah isn't yours. Before sukkah, you're using your own material. You're putting up the boards, you're putting up the schach, you're building it, it's your sukkah. The moment sukkah comes in, God says you can have no benefit from it. What does that message mean to you? What do you mean? Who are you to tell me I can have no benefit from it? It's mine, huh? It's not yours, it's mine. So we have to understand and relate to the sukkah as being something that belongs to Hashem. It's not something that belongs to us. And so when we sit inside the sukkah, whose sukkah are we sitting in? We're sitting in God's sukkah. That's what we have to understand. That pleasure and that joy that we have in the sukkah, we're enjoying something which the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us. Now taking that back to our image of the sukkah as the microcosm of the world, that means we've got to develop that concept with the whole world outside. The whole world is there for us to do what with? What are we allowed to do with the sukkah? There's only one thing we're allowed to do with the sukkah, and that is live in it. That's a pretty big thing. Living is a big word. We're not allowed to have any other benefit from it except to live in it. What about benefit from the world? The same thing. When Rebbe said before he died, although he was a very wealthy person, he said he swears by that even his little fingers never had benefit from this world. What does it mean? He's lived in the world, he's wealthy. He used to entertain a lot of guests. He used to throw enormous parties for them. What does he mean he never had benefit from this world? It means exactly that. He lived in this world. He didn't take from the world. Living is something else, and we're not going to go into a discussion right now on the difference between living in the world and taking from the world. You're not allowed to use the sukkah. You're not allowed to abuse the sukkah. What you're obligated to do is to live in the sukkah. You're not allowed to use the world. You're not allowed to abuse the world. What you've got to do is live in the world, but live in it properly, engage in the world. That's the message of sukkahs. But while there are the restrictions that there are, not restrictions of engagement, the restrictions that there are in the way we relate to the world is to stop us abusing and misusing the world. But apart from those restrictions, we're left completely free to live in the world and to engage in the proper way in the world, in the entire world. As the Gemara says, that's why the Ribbono Shel Olam created only one human being, so that we should all realize, Bishvili Nivra Ha'ilam, the whole world is there for me. Not for me to use and abuse, but for me to engage in. There's nothing in the world that is none of my business. There's nothing of the world that is not my concern. There's nothing of the world in which I don't have some kind of a relationship. Depending on what and how far, that will determine the intensity of the engagement. But there's nothing in the world that I'm not in some way engaged in. That's the message of sukkahs, to understand that we live in the world like we live in the sukkah. The world is a gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's the source of our simcha, that's the source of our joy. In fact, if we take that further, and that brings us on to the fifth theme, which is re'iyah, the obligation to go to the Beis HaMikdash every Yom Tov. I pointed out that every time that mitzvah is given to us in the Torah, the Yom Tovim are referred to in their agricultural context. Pesach is the Chag HaOviv, and Sukkot is the Chag HaOsif. Each one, it's agricultural context. And says the Ramban in Shemos, when the mitzvah of Re'iyah is given to us there, the Ramban says, and that's deliberate, because the purpose of going to Yerushalayim is to celebrate the goodness that we've achieved, our economic results. So there are three times in the year where agriculturally based businesses used to get their economic results. And that means not only agriculturally based businesses. In a country as Eretz Yisrael used to be at that time, all of business was dependent on the agriculture. And in many, perhaps most countries, if not all countries, that is so. At the end of the day, the food has to be there, the agriculture has to be in order. And there were three times in the year where people saw their results coming in. Those were the times to go to Yerushalayim. Why? Says the Rambam, to acknowledge God as the master and the source of that goodness, and to give him thanks. And when his servants take a reward from Hashem, and they come to Yerushalayim to see what he expects of them. And we discussed the whole concept of what it means to acknowledge a gift. Normally we think if we acknowledge a gift and we say thank you, that's already enough. It isn't enough. One has to realize that if one accepts a gift, one is taking on a responsibility to reciprocate. And if you don't want the responsibility to reciprocate, don't accept the gift. And what one really has to do when one receives a gift is to say thank you very much. Now what can I do for you? And that's what we do when we get a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Thank you very much. Now what can I do for you? You've done so much for me this year. What is it that I can do for you? And we have to search and examine and find what could it be that Hashem wants from me as an individual, not just what's written in the Shulchan Aruch, that he wants from everybody. But what does he want from me as an individual in reciprocation for the goodness I've got from him this particular season? That's what going to Yerushalayim meant. That's what the requirement was. What comes out of this, in fact, is that the celebration of blessing is the impetus for service of God. That unless you enjoy what God is giving you, what's going to make you go back and say, thank you, Rebbe Yishon, now what can I do for you? And that's why the danger exists in Yiddishkeit, as it does in every religion, is that our religion becomes, that our Shmiras HaMitzvahs becomes heavy, and it becomes oppressive, because it becomes a compulsive thing. That's not what it's meant to be. What it's meant to be is, Rebbe Yishon, I want to do still more for you. You've done so much for me. What can I do for you? And that should be our approach every single day. When we come to Mincha time, it shouldn't be, oh, Mincha time, quick. Let's have a Mincha quickly. Let's get it over with and get back to our work. The thing should be, Ribbono Shel Olam, I've had such a wonderful day. What can I do for you now? Have a Mincha, fine. Let's have a Mincha in a way that I've never done a Mincha before. Comes Ma'ariv time, same thing. I've just had such a good learning, say that I've learned such a beautiful piece of Gemara. Ribbono Shel Olam, what can I do for you now? Have a Ma'ariv properly, at least that. Shachris time, the same thing. An opportunity to give tzedakah, an opportunity to give a chesed. Come Shabbos around the corner. What can I do for you? That should be the driving force. But that can't be unless I'm enjoying myself. If I'm not enjoying what God's giving me, if I'm walking around still feeling all guilty about everything that God's giving me, then I don't come back to Him and say, Rebbe Yishon, what can I do for you? Rebbe Yishon, you've tempted me all week with all these beautiful goodies. Really nasty of you, God, to tempt me like that. I feel very threatened. That's not fair to put me in that kind of position. I'll get you back one day, God. That's where it ends. It doesn't create the dynamic that needs to be one of Uvenotzlom Pras Milofonov Yovoyo Elov Liris Mayutzavim. But if you see it as reward, if you see it as blessing, you want to reciprocate. And that really was the essence of this, of the theme of Shirim up until Shmini Atzeres. And that set in motion some very, very interesting discussion in the Beis HaMedrash. Because it set up in most people a dual feeling. It set up a feeling on the one hand of exhilaration, that's really exciting stuff, and very liberating stuff. It makes one feel, it makes one want to get out of there and really engage and get involved and feel the goodness of life and express it to the Ribbono Shel Olam in trying to figure out what he wants from us. And simultaneously it created in people, and very often the same people, simultaneously a sense of enormous fear and discomfort. This is going out there and engaging in the world and all that scary stuff. And what happens if we get detracted after that? And what happens if we forget to daven mincha altogether because we're so engaged in the world? And then we forget to daven ma'ariv, and then we forget to learn, and then we haven't learned for 2 weeks, and now we're not interested anymore. And now saying brachas becomes a burden, and then the next thing, even keeping kashrus becomes a, who knows where all this can lead to. So let's rather disengage from the world. Are we meant to disengage, or are we meant to engage? And it caused a lot of discomfort, which was very fascinating. The two feelings and the conflict caused by the two feelings are very, very fascinating and need to be understood, and we're only going to be able to understand one aspect of it this evening, but in this session we'll have other opportunities to look at it and to understand it. Part of the reason for the conflict is because there's too much that is written in English that shouldn't be written in English. When Chazal wrote something, they wrote it in such a way, one of the brilliances of the way Chazal wrote was that you can't understand it unless you're ready for it. That's the brilliance of it. And you've got things like that in Chol as well, in the secular world as well. I don't think it was done as deliberately. But you can't read Shakespeare until you're ready for it. you don't have to worry about spoiling Shakespeare for a 6-year-old child or for a 10-year-old child. He'll look at it, he'll read a couple of lines, and he'll say, you know, do you really want to tell me that people still read this junk? Now give me my comic books and keep your Shakespeare. You can't, there's no way that a person who's not ready for Shakespeare can enjoy it. You can't enjoy poetry until you're ready for it. Try and read poetry. If you're not ready, not only for poetry in general, if you're not ready for that poem, you won't understand it. Which is very beautiful. That's one of the beauties of art. If you're looking at a painting, you can look at a painting that you saw 20 years ago and you thought it was rubbish and you had no feeling for it. You might have even thought it was ugly. Comes a time in your life, you look at the same painting and you're able to see beauty in that. When it comes to the world of the artistic world, music is the same. You can't enjoy it until you're ready for it. Lahavdil, in the case of Chazal, it was written exactly the same way. You can't understand a medrash, you can't understand, certainly not Kabbalah, you can't understand even a piece of Chumash and Rashi until you're ready for it. No matter, unless it's explained to you by somebody who's ready for it. But then the secure thing is, at least it's explained in the context. You get it explained properly, it's fed to you correctly. The enormous danger with the English publications is all of a sudden material is now accessible to people without their being ready for it, and that is extremely dangerous. I don't know what the solution is. Go and ban all the English publications. That means that you're making inaccessible stuff which ought to be accessible. It's just hopefully people are wise, but I say hopefully, but it's not so. It's hoping for too much, that people are wise enough to be able to look at something and say, this doesn't make sense, let me ignore it until I understand it. People don't say that. They look at things in the English that are quoted sometimes out of context, or sometimes in context, but there are things that shouldn't be presented in a language that's accessible to people who are not yet ready for it. That's all that should be, and the way it is in the English, in these English publications, it's done in a way where people who don't have the digestive systems for it are fed with it nevertheless, and it makes them ill. It makes them psychologically ill. And one finds people, as I mentioned this morning in the shiur, who are plagued by fears of death and fears of retribution, and their whole Yiddishkeit has become a negative inward spiral of self-destruction rather than a joyous celebration of life and of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And part of the reason for that is this enormously heavy impact of material written in English that people are reading and absorbing before they're ready to understand it. And that creates this whole kind of fear thing, and there are all sorts of things in English, and then people came to show me various things that they've read in English about how you must disengage from the world, and it's an evil world and a bad world and a tempting world and a destructive world, and the less you have to do with it the better, and these things are all published in English, and that creates that sense of conflict and guilt. But in discussing it, in fact it was discussing it with Mrs. Zeidel, who's a member of the shir and a maths teacher, she suggested that one of the reasons, and that's what I want to work on, and she's stimulated the title of this evening's shir, is that the educational system to which we're subjected, not only in this country but throughout the Western world, is one of intolerance of mistakes. A child is taught very early on, there's one right answer, and if you get it wrong, you get naught. No matter how clever you are, and no matter how original you are, if the answer is wrong, you get naught. And you fail. And that's very serious. Now, this is the question, this is the way to do it, and this is the answer. If you can give that back to me in the exam, you will succeed. If you try and do anything clever, you will fail. And that educational system starts in the grades, or probably at nursery school, and carries on all the way till doctorate level at most universities. And we discussed this morning in the ladies' show how you walk into a nursery school and you say, hands up those of you that can paint, and all the children put their hands up. Fantastic. Hands up those of you who can sing, all of the children put their hands up. Hands up those of you who can make up a poem, they'll all put their hands up. And you'll test them, ask them, and one will make up a little poem, and one will sing a little song, and one will paint something, and usually the painting is not terribly different to the kind of paintings you see in modern art galleries, so there's nothing wrong with that kind of painting, and it's very impressive. You go into a grade 1 class, and you ask the same questions, who can sing? Everybody looks around to see if anybody else is putting up their hand, nobody puts up their hand. Who can paint? Nobody can paint. Who can make a poem? Nobody can make a poem. The creative drive is knocked out of them in 1 or 2 years. That feeling of, I better not say I can sing, because he might ask me to sing and I might get it wrong. So best just keep quiet. Let me not say I can paint, because I don't know what kind of painting he wants, and if I don't give him what he wants, I will have failed. So I would rather not fail. If you went on the board and you drew a little tree and you said, who can draw a tree like that? They would all draw it and they would all get it quite right because they know what you want and they can do it. They can give you back what you've asked for. We instill an enormous fear into people for making mistakes, getting the results wrong. There's one result and the result has to be right. And business life just reinforces that also. Results is all that matters. The results have to be right. This is the return on investment we want. Anything less than that is failure. That's the end of the story. And so one's whole life revolves around achieving specific results. Now, the achieving of results is important. I'm not for a moment suggesting that that should be annihilated from the way we educate people. I'm not for a moment suggesting that we shouldn't teach children that there's a right and a wrong answer. But what we should do is understand the importance of broadening the child out beyond just getting it right and wrong. There are a lot of other things that are more important than getting it right and wrong. Getting it right or wrong is important, but there are other things that are more important. Correct thinking, innovativeness, creativeness, legitimate, correct creativeness. All that's much more important than getting the answer right. If you've got the creativeness and the reasoning and the process is correct and you get it right, well, that's fantastic. That's when the child really should get rewarded. But at the moment, we're rewarding only for getting it right. And we do it not only in terms of academics, we do it in terms of behavior as well. And South Africa is particularly bad at that. There's one way to behave. And that's the way I tell you. And if you step out of that, I won't reason with you whether it's what's right and what's wrong about it. If it's not the way I told you, it's out. I had a case where one of the religious schools, the children wanted to go to one of the kosher restaurants for an evening, and they were told, no, they can't go. And they started questioning why not. And they weren't given a clear answer. And that was my difficulty with them. Not that they told the children they can't go, nothing wrong with that. If they can explain to the children why not, fine. But they couldn't explain, they just said, because it's not because we told you you can't go. Well, the children didn't accept that, and they questioned a little bit more. And eventually the decision of the school was, it's okay if you go by yourselves, but not with a school teacher. At that point, I picked up the phone, because I wanted to understand this new philosophy. But to let children go off to a restaurant by themselves is okay, that's fine. Who knows what they get up to there, that's fine, no problem. But to let a school teacher go with them, that not. So I phoned the principal and said, now what exactly is all this about? Can you explain the logic? I just want to understand the logic. You're teaching these children to think, and I want to know whether you're teaching them crooked or straight, because to me this sounds crooked. So the principal said, well, if they go by themselves, what they do there doesn't relate back to the school. If there's a teacher there, it reflects badly on the school. To which my response is, what are you trying to build, a school or children? Who are you educating? Are you building public relations or are you educating children? There's a right and a wrong. And unless the right and the wrong strictly conforms, we don't tolerate any deviance. That's what I tell you. It doesn't matter if it's logical or it's not logical. That's what I tell you. There needs to be a process. A child and an adult needs to be free to question. And we've discussed this several times in this shiur recently. The Torah can stand up to questioning. It's not a miserable piece of dogma that somebody thought up. It's God's brilliance. And it can stand up to questioning. You don't have to worry about the Torah. You can question it. It has to be questioned in the right way. It has to be questioned constructively. It has to be researched, not just questioned. It has to be researched. But it can stand up to questioning. When it comes to Avodas Hashem, when it comes to the Torah, we take the psychology of the fear of mistakes and we put it into Avodas Hashem, and then you've got, I'm not a psychologist, I don't know the right terms, but I would think it's a kind of psychosis that you then get. Because once you've learned, Chas v'Shalom, I should make a mistake. If the answer is 91, if the answer to the sum is 91 and I say 92, even if my method of reasoning is exactly right, that's not I guess for it. No matter how long I took to work it out and how correct it is, if I made a slip up in the last step and I said 92 instead of 91, that's not. And I can fail my year as a result of that. And so I get into a complete panic. But when it comes to Torah, it's not just failing a year. This is my Olam Habo. One slip up and an Olam Habo. And you can look up now in the art scrolls and you'll find dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds of quotes to support that. One slip up and you're dead. Not just in this world, but in the world to come as well. So watch out. One slip. No matter how correct your reasoning is, no matter how good your intention is, if the result is wrong, you're dead. Oh, that's psychosis. Now you just can't function. You can't. In that case, just tell me what you want. That's all. Write it down. tell me. What do you want me to do first thing in the morning? What do you want me to do second? I'll do what you tell me and leave me alone. I'll give it back to you as you want it, just as I gave my teacher since grade one, and leave me alone. I'll give you back the answers you want. It wasn't a tree at all, it was just an image. The tree was used as an image. The Abaibana rejects that and says it was a tree. No question about that, and that's quite clear. But he agrees, as do many other Mefarshim, that what that tree had to it was just that. That before that tree was eaten from, Adam knew what was right and was wrong. He was an enormously brilliant person. He had enormous levels of Kedusha. He was unquestionably the greatest man that has ever lived. The one way he differed from people in our age, or in any age subsequent to that, was that there was no sexual drive. And that affected issues of creativity as well, because the two are closely connected. I've pointed out before that when we talk about the Yetzer Hara, there isn't a different word for Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov. In other religions, there's a devil and there's a, I don't know what the opposite is, there's something evil and something good. We have Yetzer. Yetzer can be Ra and Yetzer can be Tov. And the word Yetzer is the creative drive, the drive of Tziur, the drive of imagination, the drive of artistic creativity, the drive of passion. It's all that is Yetzer. That Yetzer can be Tov and it can be Ra. Adam had neither of it. He didn't have Yetzer Tov and he didn't have Yetzer Ra. He was an intellect that could decide things purely on the basis of intellect. He had choices. His main choice was whether to eat from the tree or not to eat from the tree. What the Abarbanel says though is the tree was not totally forbidden. On the contrary, Hashem did not want Adam to remain with no sexual drive. He did not want Adam to remain with no creative, no artistic creative ability. He didn't want Adam and Chava to remain without passion. However, his instruction to them was that from all the trees of the gan they can eat, but not from the Eitz Hadas Tovara, not from the tree of knowledge. Eitz Hadas Tovara lo soichal mimenu. You cannot eat from the tree of Tovara. But says the Abaibanel, to look at it, yes. To admire it, yes. To smell it, yes. To feel it, to touch it, yes. And that would have introduced sufficient of a Yetzer. And that would have been Yetzer Tov. That would have been good, positive, constructive passion. And that's why it's called Eitz Hadas Tov Vera. Why is it called Eitz Hadas? Says the Abaibanel, because Das has two meanings. It means knowledge and it means sexual intimacy. Vayeda Odom Eschavu Ishto. When it uses the word for sexual intimacy, we're told the word Yoda is used. And so Eitz Hadas doesn't mean knowledge. Adam had all the knowledge beforehand. He was born with that knowledge. God created him full of knowledge. He could see from one end of the universe to the other. Adam, there was nothing lacking in Adam's knowledge. What did he need the tree for? Says the Abaibanel, the tree wasn't knowledge. Das there means sexual drive. Tov vera, good and bad. If you use it the way it was meant to be used, by smelling it, touching it, admiring it, it would give you the good drive. If you consumed it, there would be too much, and that could be negative and destructive. And interesting what that message is. What that message is that in the Garden of Eden, there were trees to be consumed, and there was a tree to be admired. There were pleasures that are achieved through consumption, and there are pleasures that are achieved through production. And the creative drive, the sexual drive, which is the source of the creative drive, is a productive source, not a consumptive drive. And that's what was important. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted it to remain a productive drive and not consumption. You don't enjoy it the same way that you enjoy the other fruits. The other fruits you enjoy by taking a bite and consuming it, swallowing it and putting it in your tummy. That's the way you enjoy it. Not so the sexual drive. That's by what you contribute, what you make the other person feel, what you're able to create in terms of the procreative ability of the sexual drive. It's there to develop the world, to grow the world, to develop other people, to create intimacy among a couple that grows them and develops them. It's all an outward drive, not an inward drive. And that was the essence of the Abaibanel, of that instruction. Admire the tree, touch the tree, love the tree, smell the tree, do what you want, but don't consume it. It's not there for consumption. That's not what the sexual drive is for. So what is Hashem saying? He's not saying disengage. He's saying engage. But the way to engage in that drive is through production, not through consumption. That's all he says. There's nothing in the world that you don't have to involve yourself in. There's nothing in the world that you're not allowed to engage in. But they're just different ways of engaging. What does he do? What does Odom do? And here's where we get the slip up. Chava then goes and she sees that they are Babel. Now the Babel, by the way, also learns very beautifully that the snake never spoke to Chava, and Chava never spoke to the snake. A snake is a snake and Chava is a Chava, and they didn't have this long discussion with one another. This was the conversation that Chava went through Chava's mind as she watched the snake intertwining himself in the tree and rubbing himself against the tree and wrapping himself around the tree. And she just looked at the snake and thought that he's enraptured. He's having such a good time. And he's not dying. He looks beautiful. He looks fantastic. He's healthy. He's good. And he's really enjoying himself. Well, you might say, so Chava, if you want to do that, climb into the tree and join the snake up there and enjoy yourself with the tree as well and smell it and wrap yourself around it and do what you want to. But she couldn't, because when the snake challenges her, she starts discussion with the snake. In her mind, says the Abarbanel, and it doesn't matter if you take it literally or you take it the way that the Abarbanel wants to take it. And she says in her mind to the snake, but Hashem said you can't do this. And he says, and what does she say exactly? It will be Priya Eitz Hashem B'Seich HaGon Omar Elokim Lo Yisoich L'Mimenu Lo Yisigubur Pentelusim. But the fruit of this tree, Hashem said, you cannot eat the Lo Yisigu Boy, and nor can you touch it, lest you die. And Chazal say, but Hashem never said that. Hashem only said, don't eat it. And as the Abarbanel said, on the contrary, God wanted them to touch it, and He wanted them to smell it, just not to eat it. Odom told her not to eat it. Why? Odom tried to create a risk-free environment. And he thought, if he instructs his wife to totally disengage, there's no chance of coming to eat it. So he caused total disengagement. Now the argument that Odom is going through is very similar to the argument that some of the people in the Beis HaMedrash felt in response to the Sukkah Shiurim. That's all very nice, but it's safer to disengage. The risks are too great. It's safer to disengage. And my argument in response to that was, don't you realize the problem is not outside of you, the problem is inside. It doesn't matter if you disengage, if you don't change yourself, it doesn't matter if you sit in a hovel at the top of a mountain, or you sit in a hovel in Bnei Brak, or you sit in a palace in London, it doesn't matter if you haven't changed. The change has to take place in you. Yes, there are risks in sitting in a palace in London. There are risks in sitting in a hovel in Yerushalayim also. The risks are different, but no less great. The Mesillas Yesharim says at the outset, wealth is a nisoyon and poverty is a nisoyon. Both of them are trials and tribulations. That's the nature of the world. The world challenges us. And every situation we find us in challenges us. But don't think for a moment that by eliminating something external, I remove the challenge. You don't. The challenge is right inside. And Odom said to himself, if I remove the tree from Chava totally, no engagement, that's the safest thing. What would have happened had Odom, and again, we're trying to understand something that is almost not understandable, but we need to learn something from it to help us, to help ourselves. What would have happened if Odom would have gone through the philosophic process? And he would have said, why did Hashem say don't eat it? Why did he say you can touch it but you can't eat it? Because he wants us to engage in it in a limited fashion, but not in a consumptive fashion. And if he would have taken Chava and taught her that, Chava, there's a very dangerous tree in the middle of the garden. It's a delicious tree. It's the best tree. It's so good that you only have to smell it. It's so good that you only have to touch it. It's so powerful that if you eat it, it will destroy you. And this is how it will destroy you. So please be careful. Touch it, smell it, admire its beauty, but don't eat it. Don't eat its fruit. That's all. Had Odom told that to Chava, the whole thing would never have happened. She would have seen the snake enjoying himself on the tree, and she would have joined in if she wanted to. But she wouldn't have eaten. She would have understood the principle. When you understand the principle, you can engage. If you don't understand the principle and you turn it into a system of regulations instead of a system of principles, then you can't engage. Then you've just got to disengage totally. And when Yiddishkeit becomes a set of rules and regulations, you can't afford yourself the luxury of engagement, because engagement means making judgments. Engagement means constantly, every moment of your life, making judgments. How far can I go? What can I do? What can't I do? In what way do I engage with this particular challenge? What is the correct way of engagement and what is the incorrect way of engagement? Is it dangerous? Yes, it's dangerous. Is it risk-free? No, it's not risk-free. But it's growth-orientated. That brings growth. And if I make a mistake, then you fix the mistake. Not if I make a mistake, I'll be dead. If I make a mistake, I fix the mistake. and very important to appreciate, is, as I mentioned, last Rosh Hashanah. When did all this take place? When did Adam sin? On the sixth day, before Shabbos. After his sin, after they ate from the apes, and after God punished them and expelled them, then it says, "Vayechulu Hashemayim v'ha'oretz v'chol tzvaon." Now God finished the creation. It's a bit late. Wasn't the creation finished just before that? Shouldn't the sin have come after Shabbos? First the creation is finished, and then the first sin? No, after the sin we say Vayechulu, because the sin was part of the creation. That's part of natural living. That's part of growth. That's part of engagement. And Hashem wanted to know that. He wanted us to know that. You're going to make mistakes. We don't have one character in the history of Torah, from the day of Bereshit until today, we don't have one character that never sinned. The Goyim have got, they're lucky. Christianity has got the man who never sinned. He died a young man, even never sinned, never did anything wrong. We don't have such a person. Nobody. Moshe Rabbeinu, Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, the greatest. There isn't anybody who did. Adam HaRishon himself. Sin was built into the Bria. You're going to make mistakes. So fix the mistakes. Sometimes you won't be able to fix them completely. Adam HaRishon spent 130 years fixing his mistake. 130 years of tshuva. Not like us, 1 month of Elul of sort of so-so tshuva, and then Rosh Hashanah with a few days of Aseret Yemei tshuva, and one day of Yom Kippur with a few moments at Ne'ilah where we really mean it. It wasn't like that. 130 years of Yom Kippur he had. That's what Adam HaRishon did. And even after the 130 years, death still stays in the world. He doesn't eradicate all the damage. Good. What can you do? So you do the best you can. But you can't eradicate the risk, because then you don't grow. Then you don't develop. If you're not willing to get out there and work with the world and work with the Torah and grow with the Torah and do it in the most legitimate way that you know how, in the way that is correct, but in one that inspires growth and develops growth, if we're not going to do that, if we're going to get scared and terrified and totally withdraw as a result of that, there's going to be absolutely no growth. We're going to remain religious pygmies and very sick people as a result of that. That's not the way the world was designed. The world was designed for engagement. I don't have time to get onto the second part of the shiur. But it revolved around the medrash that Malcolm brought in his Devar Torah this morning, where Hashem says on for Rosh Chodesh, it's the only Korban Chatos where it says Chatos laHashem, a sin offering for God, and the medrash says God asks us to bring a sin offering for Him because He made a mistake, kibiyochel, so to say, in the time of the creation. A very beautiful medrash which we'll have to deal with some other time. And of course, that can't be taken at face value. By definition, God can't make a mistake. What God does is right. Nevertheless, even though what God does is right and it cannot mean what it appears to mean on the surface, nevertheless, it says that. There's an understanding, kibiyochel, so to say, there's some times where even the Ribbono Shel Olam has to do things which have negative elements, which have damage involved. The Ribbono Shel Olam had to make a decision which caused certain damage. It was the right thing for him to do at the time. Of course it was the right thing to do, but damage was caused. And he says, bring a Korban Chatos, bring a sin offering for me every month. Even the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, or teaches us, I'm also open to that. There are things that have to be done when you're building a world, when you're developing a world, when you're engaging in life. There are things that have to be done that aren't ideal. And nobody can live his entire life according to an ideal and never deviate from that ideal. The ideal is growth. The ideal is development. The ideal is each day we should be greater than the day before. The ideal is that each day we should have learned things that we didn't know the day before, that we should be practicing things that we didn't know the day before, that our quality of interaction should be greater than it was the day before. That is the ideal. Not how many ticks we got this day, and whether we got 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10. That's not the issue. The issue is where we're going, how we're growing, and how we're developing. That's the area of growth. That is the issue that has to be confronted. And yes, there's a risk involved. If you want to put plants outside, if you want to put seeds in the ground, there's a risk involved. There might be no rain and they might all die. There might be too much sunshine and they might all die. There might be too much wind and they might all die. But they might not. And in that case, you'll have a field full of food which you'll be able to eat. Your choice is to say, no risk. I would rather sit with the money in the bank and nothing to eat than take the money and convert it into seeds and maybe I'll lose it. That's part of what we have to understand. That loss is part of growth, that loss is part of development. We lose certain things in order to move into the next phases of our lives and to be able to take on new challenges and to move into new areas. All the time, trying as hard as we can to do it correctly. Always trying to reason the way God would have us reason. All the way trying to think the way the Torah would have us think. All the way trying to get full marks. But knowing all the time that if we slip up, yes, slipping up, needs tshuva, we need to fix it. But it can be fixed. It's not the end of the world. It's okay to make mistakes. Because if we believe that it's okay to make mistakes, provided we fix those mistakes, if we believe that it's okay to make mistakes, we'll make far fewer of them in the future.